table. No straps, no handcuffs, but you won't be able to move. This is because I'll have injected you with a monster dose of succomethonium, which is a paralytic drug. Have you ever wondered what surgery feels like? Well, Mr. Burke, you'll get your own private show. The way her voice carried, Ethan knew she was standing in the middle of the corridor now, less than 4 feet away from him on the other side of the door. The only movement you'll be capable of performing is blinking. You won't even be able to scream as you feel the cutting and sawing and drilling. Our fingers inside you. The surgery will take hours, and you will be alive, awake, and fully alert for every agonizing second of it. It's the stuff of horror fiction. Ethan put his hand on the doorknob, the flush of the drug lifting now, enveloping his brain, flooding into the tips of his ears. He wondered how much more of this he could stand before his legs gave out. Turn it slowly, Ethan. Turn it so slowly. Tightening his grip on the doorknob, he waited for Nurse Pam to speak again, and when she finally did, he began to turn. "I know you can hear my voice, Mr. Burke. I'm standing just outside the room where you're hiding. Are you in the shower? Under the bed? Perhaps standing behind the door, hoping I'll walk blindly past?" She laughed. The latch cleared. He fully believed she was standing with her back to him, facing Beverly's room, but if she wasn't? "You have 10 seconds to come out, and then my generous offer of anesthesia will expire." 10. He edged the door back. 9. 3 inches. 8. 6 inches. He could see into the corridor again, and the first thing he spotted was the splash of auburn hair down Nurse Pam's back. She stood straight ahead of him. 7. Facing Beverly's door. 6. The needle gripped like a knife in her right hand. 5. He kept tugging the door back, letting it glide silently on the hinges. 4. Stopped it before it banged into the wall, now standing in the threshold. 3. He studied the floor to make sure he wasn't throwing a shadow, but even if he had been, that flickering fluorescent bulb would have masked it. 2 and 1. And now I'm angry. Very, very angry. The nurse lifted something out of her pocket, said, "I'm down in the basement, West Wing. Pretty sure he's here. I'll wait until you arrive. Over." A walkie-talkie belched static, and a male voice answered, "Copy that. On our way." The drug was hitting Ethan hard now, his knees softening, his sight beginning to come off the rails in bursts of blurriness and double vision. More people would be here momentarily. He needed to do this now, telling himself, "Go, go, go," but he wasn't sure if he even had the strength or presence of mind. He backed several steps into the room to lengthen his runway, took a long, deep breath, and went for it. 7 paces covered in 2 seconds. Collided into the nurse's back at full speed, driving her across the corridor and slamming her face first into the concrete wall. It was a hard, devastating hit that had taken her completely off guard, and so the speed and accuracy of her reaction surprised him. Her right arm swinging back, the needle stabbing him through the side. Deep, penetrating, blinding pain. He stumbled back, listing, unsteady on his feet. The nurse spun around, blood sheeting down the right side of her face where it had met with the concrete, the needle cocked back, and charged him. He could have defended himself if he'd been able to see worth a damn, but his eyesight was lagging, drawing images out across his field of vision like an ecstasy trip. She lunged, and he tried to parry back but misjudged the distance, the needle spearing him through the left shoulder. The pain when she jerked it back out nearly brought him to his knees. The nurse caught him with a perfectly placed front kick to the solar plexus, and the sheer force behind it punched him back into the wall and drove the breath out of his lungs. He'd never hit a woman in his life, but as Pam moved in for more, he couldn't shake the thought that it would feel so satisfying to connect his right elbow with this bitch's jaw. his eyes locked on the needle in her hand, thinking, "No more of that, please God." Brought his arms up to defend his face, but they felt like boulders, sluggish and cumbersome. The nurse said, "Bet you're wishing you'd just come out when I ask nicely, huh?" He lashed out at half speed with a wide arcing hook that she easily ducked, firing back with a lightning-fast jab that rebroke his nose. "You want the needle again?" she asked, and he would have charged, tried to get her on the floor, pin her underneath his weight, but proximity, considering the needle and his diminished senses, seemed like a bad idea. Pam laughed, said, "I can tell you're fading. You know, this is actually kind of fun." Ethan struggled to slide away against the wall, shuffling his feet to get out of range, but she tracked his movement, staying in front of him and aligning for another strike. "Let's play a little game," she said. "I poke you with the needle, and you try to stop me." She lunged, but there was no pain. A faint, she was toying with him. "Now the next one, Mr. Burke, is going to..." Something smashed into the side of her head with a hard thunk. Pam hit the ground and didn't move, Beverly standing over her, the frantic light blinking against her face. She still held the metal chair she'd dropped Nurse Pam with by its legs, looking more than a little shocked at what she'd done. "More people are coming," Ethan said. "Can you walk?" "We'll see." Beverly tossed the chair aside and came over to Ethan as it clattered against the linoleum floor. "Hold on to me in case your balance goes." "It's already gone." He clung to Beverly's arm as she pulled him along back down the corridor. By the time they'd reached the nurse's station, Ethan was struggling just to put one foot in front of the other. He glanced back as they rounded the corner, saw Nurse Pam struggling to sit up. "Faster," Beverly said. The main corridor was still empty, and they were jogging now. Twice Ethan tripped, but Beverly caught him, kept him upright. His eyes were growing heavy, the sedation descending on him like a warm, wet blanket, and all he wanted to do was find some quiet alcove where he could curl up and sleep this off. "You still with me?" Beverly asked.
"By a thread."
The door at the corridor's end loomed 50 feet ahead. Beverly quickened the pace. "Come on," she said. "I can hear them coming down the stairwell." Ethan heard it too, a jumble of voices and numerous footsteps behind a door they passed leading to a set of stairs. At the end of the corridor, Beverly jerked the door open and dragged Ethan across the threshold into a cramped stairwell whose 6 steps climbed to another door at the top, over which glowed a red exit sign. Beverly paused once they were through, let it close softly behind them. Ethan could hear voices on the other side, filling the corridor. Sounded like the footfalls were moving away from them, but he couldn't be sure.
"Did they see us?" he asked.
"I don't know."
It took all of Ethan's focus to climb those final steps to the exit, where they crashed through the door and stumbled outside into darkness. Ethan's feet on wet pavement and the patter of cold rain on his shoulders already beginning to seep through the paper-thin fabric of his gown. He could barely stand, and already Beverly was pulling him toward the sidewalk.
"Where are we going?" Ethan asked.
"To the only place I know they can't find you."
He followed her into the dark street. No cars out, just a smattering of streetlights and house lights, everything dim and obscured by the rain. They took the sidewalk down a quiet street, and after the second block, Ethan stopped and tried to sit down in the grass, but Beverly wouldn't let him quit.
"Not yet," she said.
"I can't go any farther.
I can barely feel my legs."
"One more block, okay? You can make it. You have to make it if you want to live. I promise you, in 5 minutes, you'll be able to lie down and ride this out."
Ethan straightened up and staggered on, followed Beverly for one more block, beyond which the houses and streetlights ended. They entered a cemetery filled with crumbling headstones, interspersed with scrub oaks and pines. It hadn't been maintained in ages, grass and weeds rising to Ethan's waist.
"Where are you taking me?"
His words slurred, felt heavy and awkward falling out of his mouth.
"Straight ahead."
They wove through headstones and monuments, most eroded so badly Ethan couldn't make out the engraving. He was cold, his gown soaked through, his feet muddy.
"There it is," Beverly pointed to a small stone mausoleum standing in a grove of aspen. Ethan struggled through the last 20 feet and then collapsed at the entrance between a pair of stone planters that had disintegrated into rubble. It took Beverly 3 digs with her shoulder to force open the iron door, its hinges grinding loudly enough to wake the dead. "I need you inside," she said. "Come on, you're almost there. 4 more feet." Ethan opened his eyes and crawled up the steps through the narrow doorway, out of the rain. Beverly pulled the door closed after him, and for a moment, the darkness inside the crypt was total. A flashlight clicked on, the beam skirting across the interior and igniting the color of a stained glass window inset in the back wall. The image, rays of sunlight piercing through clouds and lighting a single, flowering tree. Ethan slumped down onto the freezing stone as Beverly unzipped a duffel bag that had been stowed in the corner. She pulled out a blanket, unfolded it, spread it over Ethan. "I have some clothes for you as well," she said, "but you can dress when you wake up again." He shivered violently, fighting the undertow of unconsciousness, because there were things he had to ask, had to know. Didn't want to risk Beverly not being here when he woke up again. "What is Wayward Pines?" he asked. Beverly sat down beside him, said, "When you wake, I'll..." "No. Tell me now." "In the last 2 days, I've seen things that were impossible. Things that make me doubt my sanity." "You aren't crazy. They're just trying to make you think you are." "Why?" "That I don't know." He wondered if he could believe her, figured that, all things considered, it was probably wise to err on the side of skepticism. "You saved my life," he said, "and thank you for that. But I have to ask, why, Beverly? Why are you my only friend in Wayward Pines?" She smiled. "Because we both want the same thing." "What's that? To get out? There's no road out of this town, is there?"
"No.
I drove here several days ago, so how is that even possible?" "Ethan, just let the drug take you, and when you wake up, I'll tell you everything I know and how I think we can get out. Close your eyes." He didn't want to, but he couldn't stop it from happening.
"I'm not crazy," he said.
"I know that." His shivering had begun to abate, his body heat creating a pocket of warmth under the blanket.
"Tell me one thing," he said. "How did you end up in Wayward Pines?"
"I was a rep for IBM. Came here on a sales call trying to outfit the local school's computer lab with our Tandy 1000s. But as I drove into town, I got into a car accident. Truck came out of nowhere, slammed into my car."
Her voice was becoming softer, more distant, harder to follow.
"They told me I suffered a head injury and some memory loss, which is why my first recollection of this town is waking up one afternoon beside the river." Ethan wanted to tell her that the same thing had happened to him, but he couldn't open his mouth to speak, the drug plowing through his system like a rogue wave, engulfing him. He'd be gone inside a minute.
"When?"
he rasped. She didn't hear him, had to lean in close, put her ear to his mouth, and it took everything in his power to get the question out.
"When did you come here?"
he whispered, clinging to her words now like a life preserver that could keep him afloat, keep him awake. But still he was slipping under, seconds of consciousness remaining. She said, "I'll never forget the day I arrived, because in some ways it's like the day I died. Since then, nothing's been the same. It was a beautiful autumn morning, sky a deep blue, the aspen turning. That was October 3rd, 1985. In fact, next week is my anniversary. I'll have been in Wayward Pines a whole year."
Chapter 8. She didn't dare open the door. Glanced instead through one of the missing panes in the stained glass window, found nothing to see through the midnight rainfall, and nothing to hear above the sound of it on the weeds and the trees and the mausoleum roof. Ethan was gone, lost to the drug, and in some ways, she envied him. In sleep, the dreams came to her,
of her life before, of a man whom, in all likelihood, she would have married, of her home with him in Boise. All the plans they'd made together, the children they had one day hoped to bring into the world, sometimes she even dreamed about their faces. Waking was Wayward Pines, this beautiful hell. When she'd first arrived, the surrounding cliffs had filled her with awe and wonder. Now she hated them for what they were, what they'd become. Prison bars surrounding this lovely town where no one could leave, and those few who tried. She still had nightmares about those nights. The sound of 500 telephones ringing at once. The screaming. Not tonight. That is not going to happen tonight. Beverly pulled off her poncho and went to him, curled up under the blanket against the wall. When the pattern of his breathing finally slowed into long respirations, she crawled over to the duffel bag and fished the knife out of an exterior pocket. It was a folder, rusted and dull, but it was all she'd been able to find. She tugged the blanket away and pulled up Ethan's hospital gown and ran her hand along his left leg until she felt the bump on the back of his thigh. Let her hand linger there a shade longer than she should have, hating herself for it, but God, it's been so long since she'd even touched or been touched by a man. She'd considered telling Ethan ahead of time, but his impaired state had prevented this, and maybe that was for the best. Regardless, he was lucky. She hadn't had the benefit of anesthesia when she'd done this to herself. Beverly set the flashlight on the stone floor so it illuminated the backside of his left thigh. It was covered in scars. You couldn't see the bump, only feel it, and just barely, if you knew exactly where to touch. She pried open the blade, which she'd sterilized 2 hours ago with cotton balls and alcohol, her stomach lurching at the thought of what she had to do, praying the pain wouldn't break his sedation. Chapter 9. Ethan dreamed he'd been tied down and that something was eating his leg, taking small, probing bites that occasionally went deep enough for him to cry out in his sleep. He slammed awake, groaning. Darkness everywhere, and his left leg, high on the back of his thigh, burning with a pain he knew all too well, someone was cutting him. For a terrible moment, he was back in that torture room with black-hooded Asif, hanging from the ceiling by his wrists, his ankles chained to the floor, and his body taut so he couldn't struggle, so he couldn't even move, no matter how awful the pain. Hands shook his shoulders. A woman's voice said his name. "Ethan! You're all right. It's over."
"Please stop. Oh, God, please stop."
"You're safe. I got it out." He registered a splash of light, blinked several times until it sharpened into focus. A flashlight beam shone on the floor. In the indirect light, he glimpsed stone walls, two crypts, a stained glass window, and then it all came roaring back. "You know where you are?" Beverly asked. His leg hurt so much he thought he was going to throw up.
"My leg. Something's wrong."
"I know. I had to cut something out of it." His head was clearing. The hospital, the sheriff, his attempt to leave town all coming back, the memories trying to reassemble themselves into a sequence that made sense. He thought he'd seen Kate as well, but wasn't sure. That piece felt too much like a dream, or a nightmare. With newfound clarity, the pain in his leg was making it difficult to concentrate on anything else. "What are you talking about?" he asked. Beverly lifted the flashlight and let it shine on her right hand, where between her thumb and first finger she held something that resembled a microchip, specks of drying blood still caught up in the semiconductor. "What is that?" he asked. "How they monitor and track you." "That was in my leg?" "They're embedded in everyone's." "Give it to me."
"Why?"
"So I can stomp it into pieces."
"No, no, no. You don't want to do that."
"Then they'll know you removed it."
She handed it to him.
"Just ditch it in the cemetery when we leave."
"Won't they find us in here?"
"I've hidden here with the chip before. These thick stone walls disrupt the signal.
But we can't stay here long. They can track the chip to within 100 yards of where the signal drops.
Ethan struggled to sit up. He folded back the blanket to uncover a small pool of blood, glistening on stone under the flashlight beam. More red eddies trickled out of an incision site on the back of his leg. He wondered how deep she'd had to dig. Felt lightheaded, his skin achy and clammy with fever.
"You have something in the bag to close this wound?" he asked.
She shook her head. "Just duct tape."
"Get it. Better than nothing."
Beverly pulled the duffel bag over and thrust her hand inside. Ethan said,
"Did I dream you told me you came here in 1985? Or did that really happen?"
"That happened."
She pulled out a roll of tape.
"What do I do?" she asked. "I have no medical training."
"Just wrap it around my leg several times."
She started a piece of tape and then moved in, winding it carefully around Ethan's thigh.
"Is that too tight?"
"No, it's good. You need to stop the bleeding."
She made 5 revolutions and then ripped the tape and smoothed it down.
"I'm going to tell you something," Ethan said. "Something that you won't believe."
"Try me."
"I came here 5 days ago.
"You already told me that."
"The date was September 24th, 2012.
For a moment, she just stared at him.
"Ever heard of an iPhone?" Ethan asked.
She shook her head.
"The internet? Facebook? Twitter?" And kept shaking it.
Ethan said, "Your president is..."
"Ronald Reagan."
"In 2008, America elected its first black president, Barack Obama." "You've never heard of the Challenger disaster?" He noticed the flashlight beginning to tremble in her hand.
"No."
"The fall of the Berlin Wall?"
"No, none of it."
"The 2 Gulf Wars, September 11th?
"Are you playing some mind game with me?"
Her eyes narrowed, 1 measure of anger, 2 of fear.
"Oh, God. You're with them, aren't you?"
"Of course not."
"How old are you?"
34. "And your birthday is?"
"November 1st.
"What year?"
1950.
"You should be 61 years old, Beverly."
"I don't understand what this means," she said.
"Makes 2 of us.
"The people here, they don't talk to each other about anything outside of Wayward Pines," she said. "It's one of the rules."
"What are you talking about?"
"They call it live in the moment. No talk of politics is allowed. No talk of your life before. No discussions of pop culture, movies, books, music. At least nothing that isn't available here in town. Don't know if you've noticed, but there are hardly any brand names. Even the money is weird. I didn't realize it until recently, but all the currency is from the 50s and 60s. Nothing later. And there are no calendars, no newspapers. Only way I know how long I've been here is because I keep a journal."
"Why is it like this?"
"I don't know. But the punishment for slipping up is severe."
Ethan's leg throbbed from the constriction of the duct tape, but at least the bleeding had subsided. He let it ride for now, but he'd have to loosen it soon. Beverly said,
"If I find out you're with them..."
"I am not with them, whoever they are."
There were tears building in her eyes. She blinked them away and wiped the glistening trails off the sides of her face. Ethan leaned back against the wall. The chills and the aches getting worse. He could still hear the rain beating down above them, and it was still night beyond that stained glass window. Beverly lifted the blanket off the floor and draped it over Ethan's shoulders.
"You're burning up," she said.
"I asked you what this place was, but you never really answered me."
"Because I don't know."
"You know more than me."
"The more you know,
the stranger it becomes, the less you know. You've been here a year. How have you survived? She laughed, sad and resigned. By doing what everyone else does? Buying into the lie? What lie? That everything's fine. That we all live in a perfect little town. Where paradise is home.
What?
Where paradise is home? It's something I saw on a sign on the outskirts of town when I was trying to drive out of here last night.
When I first woke up here, I was so disoriented and in so much pain from the car accident, I believed them when they told me I lived here. After wandering around in a fog all day, Sheriff Pope found me. He escorted me to the beer garden, that pub where you and I first met. Told me I was a bartender there, even though I'd never tended bar in my life. Then he took me to a little Victorian house I'd never seen before. Told me it was home.
And you just believed him?
I had no competing memories, Ethan. I only knew my name at that point.
But the memories came back.
Yes. And I knew something was very wrong. I couldn't make contact with the outside world. I knew this wasn't my life. But there was something, I don't know, sinister about Pope. On some instinctive level, I knew better than to question him about anything. I didn't have a car, so I started taking long walks toward the outskirts of town. But a strange thing happened. Every time I'd get near to where the road looped back, guess who showed up? It dawned on me that Pope wasn't really a sheriff. He was a warden. For everyone who lived here. I realized he must be tracking me somehow, so for 2 months I kept my head down, went to work, went home, made a few friends.
And they'd bought into all this as well.
I don't know. On a surface level, they never blinked, never gave any indication that things were out of the ordinary. After a while, I realized it must be fear that was keeping everyone in line, but of what, I didn't know. And I sure didn't ask.
Ethan thought back to the neighborhood party he'd stumbled upon. God, was it just last night? And how normal it had seemed, how perfectly ordinary. He thought of all the quaint Victorian houses in Wayward Pines, and of all the families who lived inside them. How many residents, inmates, kept up a strong, carefree countenance during the day, but then lay awake at night, sleepless, mind racing, terrified and struggling to comprehend why they'd been locked away in this scenic prison. He imagined more than a few. But human beings were, if nothing else, adaptable. He figured just as many had convinced themselves, convinced their children, that things were exactly as they should be. As they'd always been. How many lived day to day, in the moment, banishing any thought or remembrance of the life they had known before? It was easier to accept what could not be changed than to risk everything and seek out the unknown. What lay beyond? Long-term inmates often committed suicide, or reoffended, when faced with the prospect of life outside the prison walls. Was it so different here? Beverly continued.
One night at the bar, a few months after my arrival, this guy slipped me a note. It said, "The back of your left thigh." That night in the shower, I felt it for the first time. A small bump, something under the skin, although I didn't know what I was supposed to do about it. Next night, he was back at my bar. Scribbled a new message, this time on the ticket. "Cut it out, keep it safe, it's how they track you." First 3 times, I chickened out. The 4th, I manned up and did it. By day, I always kept the chip with me, carried on like everyone else. And the weird thing is that there were moments when it almost felt normal. I'd be at someone's house having dinner or a neighborhood block party, and I'd catch this feeling like Maybe it had always been this way, and that my prior life was the dream. I started to see how people could grow to accept a life in Wayward Pines. At night, after my shift ended at the pub, I'd go home, leave the chip in my bed where I was supposed to be, and head out. Each night, a different direction. I kept running into dead ends. To the north, east, and west were these towering cliff walls, and I could climb them for 100 feet or so, but the ledges inevitably got thinner, and I would always run out of handholds or come to a point where I didn't have the guts to keep climbing. I came across more than a few skeletons at the base of those cliffs. Old broken bones. Human. People who had tried to climb out and taken a fall. Fourth time I ventured out, I went south up the main road, the one I'd driven into Wayward Pines. I found what you found. It just looped back into town, back into itself in an endless circle. But I kept heading south into the woods. Must have gone a half mile before I finally came to the fence.
A fence?
The throbbing in Ethan's leg had become unbearable, worse than the pain of Beverly's incision. He loosened the duct tape. It was 20 feet high, and it ran through the forest in either direction as far as I could see. There was barbed wire across the top, and it hummed like it was electrified. The same sign was attached to the fencing every 50 feet. It said, "Return to Wayward Pines. Beyond this point, you will die." Ethan rewrapped his leg. The throbbing had faded, and there was still pain, but it seemed to have dulled.
"Did you find a way through?"
"No." It was getting near dawn, and I thought I'd better get back to town. But when I turned to go, there was a man standing in front of me. Scared me to death until I realized who it was.
"Guy who told you about the chip?"
"Exactly. He said he'd been following me. Every night I'd gone out."
"Who was he?" Ethan asked, and he couldn't be sure in the low light, but it looked as though a shadow passed across Beverly's face.
"Bill."
A prickling sensation, like a low amp current, ripped through Ethan's body. "What was Bill's last name?" he asked.
"Evans."
"Jesus."
"What?"
"Evans was the dead man in the house, the one you steered me toward."
"Right. I wanted you to understand right off how dangerous this place is."
"Message received." "Evans was one of the Secret Service agents I was sent to Wayward Pines to find."
"I didn't know Bill was Secret Service. He wouldn't tell me anything about what we called our lives before."
"How did he die?" Beverly lifted the flashlight off the floor, its bulb beginning to weaken in intensity. She switched it off. Total darkness. The whisper of rain and nothing else.
"It happened the night we tried to escape. I still don't understand exactly how they found out, because we left our microchips in our beds like we'd done so many times before. Bill and I met up at our predetermined spot with supplies and provisions. But we never had a chance."
Ethan could hear the grief splitting her voice.
"We had to go separate ways," she said. "I made it back to my house, but they caught him. Tore him apart."
"Who tore him apart?"
"Everyone."
"Who's every?"
"The entire town, Ethan. I could hear him screaming from my house, but there was nothing I could do. At last I understood. I realized what it was that kept everyone here."
For what seemed a long, long time, neither of them spoke. Finally, Ethan said, "I never made it to the fence, but I did wander a ways into the woods beyond the curve in the road at the south end of town. This was just last night. I could swear I heard something."
"What?"
"It was a scream. Or a cry. maybe something in between. And the weird thing was this feeling like I'd heard it before, in a dream, or another life. It filled me with terror on such a base level, like the howl of a wolf. Something deeply ingrained. My only response was to run. So now I hear you telling me about this electrified fence, and I'm wondering, why is it there? Is it to keep us in, or to keep something out? At first, Ethan thought the sound was coming from inside his head, some after-effects of the drug Nurse Pam had given him, or the trauma of Pope's beating and everything he'd experienced since. But the noise quickly grew. Something was ringing. No. Many things were ringing. Hundreds and hundreds of them. "What is that?" Ethan asked, struggling onto his feet. Beverly was already at the door, fighting to pull it open, the hinges grinding, and then a blast of cold air swept into the crypt, and the noise grew suddenly loud. Ethan realized what it was. The sound of 500 rotary telephones going off at once, filling the valley with a bright, eerie ringing.
"Oh, God," Beverly said. "What's happening?" "This is how it started the night Bill died. I don't understand. Every telephone in every house in Wayward Pines is ringing right now. People are being told to find and kill you."
Ethan braced for the impact of that piece of information, but he was only vaguely aware that he should be scared shitless, something he knew but didn't feel. His mind already roping itself off, sliding into that numb, adrenalized state of rote survival he'd tasted those few times in his life when he'd had the misfortune to lock eyes with death. No place for extraneous, wasted thought or emotion. All power diverted and channeled so it could heighten the only thing that could keep him alive, sensory perception. "I'll go ditch the chip and hide here," he said. "Wait them out."
"There are just over 500 people living in Wayward Pines, and every one of them will be looking for you. I'm thinking eventually someone's going to come through this door, and you don't want to be here when that happens."
Ethan grabbed the flashlight out of her hand and flicked it on, limped over to the duffel bag. "What's in there?" he asked, going down on his knees beside the bag.
"Clothes for you, shoes. I had to guess your size.
Weapons?
Sorry. Couldn't get my hands on any."
Ethan started pulling things out, a long-sleeved black tee, black jeans, black shoes, 2 dozen bottles of water.
"Turn off the light," Beverly hissed at him.
Ethan killed it.
"You have to go right now," she said. "They're coming.
Just let me get dressed and—"
"They're already in the cemetery. I can see their flashlights."
Ethan left everything strewn across the floor and staggered over to the iron door. Out in the darkness, he spotted 4 points of light weaving through the headstones. They appeared to be a few hundred feet away, although judging distance was a challenge in this weather. The telephones had gone quiet. Beverly whispered in Ethan's ear,
"You need to find the river at the southwest end of town. That's the route Bill and I had planned to take. It's the only direction I haven't thoroughly explored. Bill went up a little ways and thought it looked promising."
"Where do we meet?"
"Just get to the river and follow it upstream. I'll find you."
Beverly pulled the hood of her poncho over her head, stepped down out of the mausoleum, and sprinted off into the night, Ethan listening as the sound of her footsteps dwindled away and were soon lost to the steady rain. He lingered in the threshold, alternating his attention between the approaching lights and the pitch darkness of the crypt, wondering if he had 2 minutes to spend getting dressed and gathering supplies, or if he just needed to go. The beams of light drew closer, all 4 of them moving in the general direction of the mausoleum and bringing voices along with them. "Decide, damn it." He was wasting precious seconds. "If they reach you while you're in the crypt, you're dead. There is no escape, and they could be here in less time than it will take you to dress." He ran. Wearing nothing but a hospital gown, shoeless, his bare feet swishing through grass and squishing through patches of cold mud, rain pelting him, achy, racked with chills. His left hamstring screaming with every flexion. He shut it all away, the fear, the agony, the cold, and tore through the pines, dodging gravestones. The four points of light behind him didn't appear to have noticed his exit as they were still on an intersecting trajectory with the mausoleum. In near total darkness, the disorientation was staggering. He had no idea if he was heading north or south, toward town or away, but he kept running until he reached a stone wall that formed the decrepit border of the cemetery. Climbing over, he straddled it, taking a moment to catch his breath and glance back the way he'd come. More lights. At least a half dozen newbies in addition to the original four, and there were more appearing every second behind those, a veritable army of fireflies emerging in the dark and all moving toward him with a kind of bobbling motion that made him fear the people holding them were running. Ethan dropped the microchip on the stone wall. Then he swung his legs over and hopped down on the other side, wincing at the biting pain in his left hamstring. But he ignored it and pushed on into a field of cut grass. On the far side, playground equipment gleamed and he could see the rain pouring through the illumination of an overhanging street lamp. Beyond, in a stand of dark pines, more flashlights, more voices. Someone shouted back in the cemetery, and though he couldn't tell if this was directed at him, it had the effect of accelerating his pace. Approaching the swing set and sliding board, it occurred to him where he was, and the burbling of running water above the rainfall and the pounding of his heart confirmed it. Though he couldn't see in the dark, on his left lay the grassy riverbank where he'd first come to consciousness in Wayward Pines 5 days ago, and the river. He almost course-corrected to move toward it, but then a light winked on down where he imagined the shore should be. Ethan streaked past the sliding board, shouldered through a hedge of dripping bushes that nearly ripped the flimsy hospital gown off him, and stumbled out into the street. The gown hung in tatters around his neck like a shredded cape. He tore it off, desperately needing oxygen. A full minute of deep inhalations wouldn't be enough, but there was no time to stop and replenish his lungs. Lights from the cemetery, the river, and the pines on the north end of the park had converged in that open field in a luminescent swarm that moved toward him now as a single entity, accompanied by a jumble of voices, drunk with the giddy exuberance of a chase. A fresh shot of adrenaline spiked Ethan's blood. His muddy feet hammered the wet pavement as he sprinted naked up the middle of the street, rain sheeting down his face. Realized that his objective had moved. Forget reaching the river, he needed to find some place to hide and ride this madness out. Didn't know how many people were chasing him, how many had already seen him, but streaking naked through town was going to get him killed in a hurry. A deep voice shouted, "There!" Ethan glanced back, saw three shadows dart out of a large Victorian house, the man in front tearing down the steps, through the front yard, and leaping over the white picket fence with considerable grace while his companions bunched up at the gate, fumbling with the latch. The hurdler hit the sidewalk mid-stride and accelerated, dressed all in black, boots pounding the street. He carried a machete whose wet blade glimmered under the glancing beam of his headlamp, running hard, breathing hard, and a voice in Ethan's head said flatly, with the dead calm of a filibustering senator reading a phone book at 3 in the morning, "That man is 50 yards away, he's armed, and he's going to catch you. What are you going to do about it?" Chapter 10. Accessed from the attic, it is the highest window in the house. Teardrop shaped with an overhanging eave that keeps the glass protected from the rain. It is late and dark, and the hush of rainfall on the tin roof above her head would be a peaceful sound on any other night. A sound to sleep to dream to. Her telephone didn't ring with all the others, and for this she is grateful. She'd prayed they wouldn't expect her to take part in this, and that confirmation is a small comfort in the midst of this nightmare. From her vantage point on the third floor, she can see the flashlights appearing across the valley like the lights of a great city coming to life. hundreds of them. Most distant, nothing more than motes of brilliance in the pouring rain. Others close enough to see individual cones of light sweeping through the mist that is beginning to form in the alleys and depressions. When he comes into view, her heart stops. Naked. Pale. Running like a ghost up the middle of the street and pursued by a trio of black-garbed men with machetes. She's known this was coming. Thought she'd prepared herself as much as one can for such a thing, but seeing him in the flesh, his fear, his panic, his despair, she has to bite her lip to stop herself from screaming out to him. I'm watching his execution. Ethan passes out of view, moving toward the buildings that line Main Street. And it hits her like a load of double-aught buckshot to the chest. She has seen him for the last time, because she will not go to the house on First Avenue to witness what's left of him, to see the damage inflicted upon her husband, the father of her son. More people flood up the street en masse, everyone racing toward Maine. Despite the dreary weather, it's a carnival atmosphere. And more she sees costumes, many no doubt prepared in advance. Though no one ever speaks of the fete, she knows there are people who long for the telephones to ring, for the chance to run amok in the wee hours of the night, to draw blood. She and Ben joined the mob last time, as if they'd had a choice, and while they hadn't found their way into the eye of the storm that had actually beaten Bill Evans to death, they'd been caught up in the periphery. Heard his screams and pleas against the laughter and maniacal taunting of the crowd. Afterward, the entire town had reveled on Main Street until dawn, liquor flowing, fireworks exploding, dancing, singing, feasting, and while she couldn't help but feel sickened by it all, an undeniable oneness buzzed through the crowd like the air itself had been electrified. Everyone embracing, effervescent. A night for humanity in all its evil, joy, and madness. A celebration in hell. Her 5 years in Wayward Pines, there'd been only 4 fetes. Tonight makes 5. Teresa wipes her face and turns away from the window. Moves quietly through the empty attic, mindful to keep her footsteps gentle on the creaky hardwood. If she wakes Ben and he sees a fete in progress, he'll want to go outside, be a part of it. She descends the drop-down ladder, folds it up, raises the attic door back into the ceiling. So strange to be standing on the second floor of this silent house, considering what's happening outside. She walks down the hallway and stops in the open doorway of Benjamin's room. He sleeps. 12 years old and looking more and more like his father every day. Watching him, she wonders if, when they finally catch him, Ethan will cry out. Will she hear him? And if so, will she be able to stand it? Sometimes things feel so normal. So, as they always have been, but then come moments when the buried tension of questions she no longer allows herself to ask threatens to shatter her like ancient crystal. Soon there will be music on Main Street, and chances are it will wake her son. Ben will want to know what's happening, and there will be no lying to him. No sugarcoating. He's too smart for that, and she respects him far too much. What will she tell him? And the harder question. A week from now, when she wakes in the middle of the night, alone in her dark bedroom, with no possibility of ever seeing her husband again, what will she tell herself? Chapter 11. Ethan rushed through the next intersection, more lights appearing every time he glanced back, but his nearest pursuer, the hurdler, was his immediate concern. The man had broken ahead of his slower compatriots, Ethan thinking he looked familiar, the bald head, the huge, silver-frame glasses, and as the man closed to within 30 feet, Ethan realized who it was. that prick pharmacist he'd tried to buy aspirin from 2 days prior. Main Street loomed one block ahead, a disturbing noise bubbling up over the 2- and 3-story buildings, the ebullient chatter of a gathering crowd. Under no circumstances could he run naked onto Main Street, but at his current clip, and without altering his trajectory, in another 20 seconds he would do that very thing. One street stood between Ethan and Main, and it wasn't even a street, just a one-lane alley that slashed behind the row of buildings. It gave him one last boost of rage-infused adrenaline to acknowledge that if he rounded the corner into that alley and came upon anybody, anybody at all, he was done. Hacked to death by a machete-wielding pharmacist. Nice way to go. A one-story garage abutted the street, and he figured the corner of the building, when he turned it, would break the pharmacist's line of sight for about 2 seconds. If there wasn't a crowd waiting for him in the alley, it might be enough. Ethan had been sprinting up the dead center of the street, but now it was time to make his move. He veered right, cutting across the rain-slicked pavement. Must not fall. Crossed a strip of grass, then sidewalk, then grass again, and as he reached the opening of the alley, it occurred to him that he didn't even know what he was going to do. No time to plan, just react. By the proximity of the man's footfalls, he estimated the pharmacist to be 6 strides back. Ethan shot into the alley, concrete to dirt, darker. Mist tinged with the reek of wet garbage. He saw no one in the immediate vicinity beyond a pair of flashlights several 100 feet down, meandering his way. Ethan kicked his feet sideways and parallel, as if shredding to a stop on skis, arresting his forward momentum as he skidded to such an abrupt halt he could feel gravity fighting to flip him end over end. He righted himself and exploded back the way he'd come, accelerating straight at the corner of the building. Be there. Be there. Be there. The collision was tremendous, Ethan's forehead smashing flush into the lower half of the pharmacist's jaw in a bone-fracturing wreck so intense the impact left Ethan out on his feet for a half a second. He snapped back, blood sheeting down his face. The pharmacist sitting stunned and spitting teeth onto the road. In the aftermath of the brain-scrambling hit, it took Ethan 2 seconds to realize that the long, metal object lying on the pavement was the man's machete. He reached down and lifted it as the man looked up at him, the horror of knowing what was about to happen dragging him back into coherence more effectively than a bucket's worth of smelling salts. Ethan squeezed his fingers into the indentations in the machete's handle, which had been wrapped in duct tape for improved grip in the rain. The man raised his arms in a feeble attempt to fend off what could not be fended off. Ethan feigned a strike and drilled the man in the face with a front kick, his heel thrusting through the wreckage of the man's crushed nose and driving the back of his head into the pavement with a skull-fracturing crunch. The man groaned and stayed down, but his 2 friends were closing in. They'd be here in 10 seconds, and behind them, a block back, that army of flashlights moved like a herd of cattle up the street, the sound of numerous footfalls on wet pavement getting louder and louder. Ethan fled back into the alley, relieved to find that those pair of lights he'd seen last time had vanished. He ran, needing to make the most of his brief window of invisibility. 20 steps in, he neared a dumpster and didn't even hesitate. Ducked around the side, hit the ground, crawled behind it, wedging himself between the metal and the brick wall of the building it nestled against. He couldn't hear anything over the thundering of his heart and his dog-like panting, sweat and blood pouring down his face into his eyes, freezing, muscles blazing with a lactic acid burn like he'd just hit the wall on a marathon. Footsteps raced past on the other side of the dumpster, and the sound of them moving away, getting steadily softer, was like music. The side of Ethan's face rested on the ground, dirt and bits of glass and gravel embedding in his cheek. Rain drummed on his back and collected all around him in pools that shivered with each new droplet. He could have lain there all night and long into the following day.
Get your ass up. You can't afford to get stiff.
Ethan placed his palms on the wet gravel and struggled up onto his hands and knees. He backed out of the space between the dumpster and the building and crouched for a moment beside the trash bin, listening.
Distant voices. Distant footsteps. The commotion on Main. But nothing sounded dangerously close.
He stood, glanced back toward the opening of the alley, and saw the crowd moving past at a jog, climbing the street toward whatever was happening on Main. Keeping close to the brick wall, Ethan headed in the opposite direction, into the misty darkness of the alleyway. 30 feet down, there was a break in the brick, a wooden door. He looked back toward the dumpster, to the street beyond. Now someone was coming, a beam of light sweeping back and forth across the alley, coupled with the crunch of gravel under footsteps. Ethan tugged the door open, light from inside throwing a patch of illumination into the alley that diffused through the mist. He rushed through into a bright stairwell, pulled the door closed after him, and turned to flip the deadbolt. The cylinder had been drilled out like a cavity and filled in with solid metal. No way to lock it. Ethan raced up the narrow stairwell, the stress of climbing sending new shoots of pain through the back of his left leg. As he reached the second floor landing, the alleyway door burst open. Ethan glanced back down the stairs at a large man standing in a dripping yellow poncho, flashlight in one hand, a butcher knife Ethan figured he'd liberated from a home cutlery block in the other. The man's eyes stayed hidden under the shadow of the hood, but his jaw was set and his hands, particularly the one holding the knife, were rock steady, betraying no evidence of nerves. Ethan rushed across the landing and up the next set of steps as the stairwell filled with the reverberation of booted footfalls. On the third floor landing, Ethan crashed through a doorway. The corridor stood quiet, empty, dimly lit. Sconces that resembled lanterns had been mounted to the wall at intervals of 20 feet. Brass numbers centered on each door. An apartment building? Ethan heard the footsteps pounding up the stairwell. Started down the hallway, trying every doorknob he passed. Locked. 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 Knowing any second the stairwell door would break open. Locked. Locked. The seventh door he tried, number 19, turned. He tightened his grip on the machete in the event someone waited on the other side, and nudged the door open with his toes. A small, dark apartment. Seemingly empty. He slipped inside and shut the door at the same moment the stairwell door punched open. Ethan reached up, hooked the chain into the guard. Lingering by the entrance, he listened as the door out in the hallway swung closed. The footsteps slowed considerably, knocking against the hardwood floor. No more rushing, no frantic pounding. Ethan could almost picture the man in the yellow poncho moving methodically down the corridor. He had to know that Ethan had slipped into one of the apartments, but he'd have no way of knowing which one. The footsteps approached, and now that this one was locked as well, and stopped on the other side. Close enough that when Ethan looked down, he could see the light slipping under the door broken in two places. How the hell had the man known exactly where to stop? Shit. Muddy footprints. One of the foot shadows on the floor disappeared and the hardwood in the corridor creaked from wood pressure. Ethan staggered back, slipping around the right-hand corner into a kitchenette. The sound of splintering wood, the chain snapping. Light from the corridor poured into the dark apartment. Yellow Poncho had kicked the door in. Standing with his back against a humming refrigerator, Ethan could see the silhouette of the man's shadow yawning across the carpeting into the apartment. The shadow lengthened as the man stepped over the threshold and moved slowly down the short hallway that opened into a living area. Several feet back from the kitchen, he stopped. Ethan could hear his poncho dripping on the carpet. The man's elevated breathing as Ethan tried to suppress his own. A soft click, and then a beam of light shot into the living area and tracked slowly across the wall, where bookshelves surrounded two large windows, presently curtained. Through them, Ethan could hear the noise down on Main steadily increasing. The light struck a leather sofa and a coffee table, upon which a mug on a coaster exhaled coils of steam that filled the apartment with the sleepy sweetness of chamomile tea. The light moved across a framed photograph, an aspen grove in full autumn color, snow-dusted mountains in the backdrop, October sky burning blue above it all, and then swept into the kitchen, passing over the stove, cabinets, coffee maker, gleaming off the stainless steel sink on its way toward Ethan. He ducked, crawled across the linoleum, and crouched in the shadow between the island and the sink. The man came forward, Ethan watching the light beam strike the refrigerator where he'd been standing 5 seconds ago. The footsteps moved on. In the microwave door above the stovetop, Ethan locked on the reflection of the man in the yellow poncho, who now stood in the living area, staring toward a doorway in the north wall that opened into a bedroom. Ethan struggled slowly onto his feet, the noise of the crowd masking the popping of his knees. He stood facing Yellow Poncho's back as the man edged forward with careful purpose toward the bedroom. Ethan crept around the island and then out of the kitchen. At the coffee table, he stopped. Yellow Poncho stood in the threshold of the bedroom, 12 feet away, shining his flashlight into the room. Ethan tightened his grip on the machete's duct-taped handle and scraped the pad of his thumb over the edge of the long blade. It could have been sharper, a lot sharper. He'd have to swing hard. Go, rush him, right now while you still have the element of surprise. He hesitated. Ethan had caused plenty of suffering and death, but the raw intimacy of violence was diluted from the cockpit of a Black Hawk. Sending laser-guided hellfires into a target 2 miles away wasn't in the same wheelhouse as killing a civilian with a machete in close quarters like this. One was a few steps above a video game. The other. The man spun around in the doorway and faced Ethan. Both men started breathing faster. "Why are you doing this?" Ethan asked. No response. He couldn't see anything of the man's face now. Just his profile, the shadow of the knife in his right hand, and a splash of illumination on his boots, the flashlight aimed at the floor. Ethan had opened his mouth to repeat the question when the light swung up, blazing straight at his face, into his eyes. Something clattered to the floor. Darkness resumed. Ethan couldn't see anything against the retinal overload, standing blind in a gray darkness without form or detail. Footsteps were coming, the hardwood floor under the carpet straining with each stride, the man's jeans swishing as he charged. Ethan staggered back, his vision recovering, captured a snapshot of Yellow Poncho 3 feet away, the butcher knife cocked back and poised for a downward strike. Ethan swung, a hard lightning slash. The blade met no resistance, and the force of the swipe spun him around and off balance, Ethan thinking, "I missed. I'm dead." The man moved past him, stumbling awkwardly across the room until he finally caught himself on the bar side of the kitchen island. Ethan regained his balance, and as he improved his grip on the machete, making certain it was sound, he noticed blood dripping off the end of the blade. Ethan looked back toward the kitchen. The man had dropped his knife and was facing Ethan, leaning back against the island, both hands clutching the left side of his neck, which made a hissing sound like compressed air escaping from a tire.